welcome to today's episode of the Learning Value Podcast. I'm John Howie, along with Laura Archers, and our guest today is Mr. Richard Rush. I'm very excited about our guest today. I've known Richard for probably three decades and that kind of thing. And he's one of those guys who I first met him, and he was a school teacher who used to be a nuclear medical technician. Wasn't surprised at all when I ran into him 6 months later and he had a master's degree. Then I didn't talk to him for years. And then last time I talked to him, he's got a PhD and he's living in Vancouver. And just in conversation now, I discovered he just built a waterfall in his backyard. He's just one of those guys who's got a great breadth and depth of knowledge and just does all these amazing things all the time. It just blows me away. So welcome, Richard. Very happy to have you here. I'll pass it over to Laura, who can do her introduction in our Richard Rush Love Fest.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's exciting for me about this conversation is that, you know, the very first time that I ever really had any appreciation for data when it comes to learning and development was through you, Richard. Like I you know, prior to that, I had no context for it. And I think I referred to before that I kind of grew up in that technology company that I ended up reporting to you inside of. And I just, you know, I reflect on that time a lot, because since then I've gotten a deeper and deeper appreciation, but there's still so much that I could learn around data and what it tells us in the learning space. And so I, you know, what I'd love to do, knowing that we've got a history with each other and knowing that you've definitely had a journey since then, would love for you to share a little bit about your journey since the last time we had a chance to work and talk together. And specifically, like, why has the passion for data for you persisted throughout your entire career? So would love for you just to share about that.
Yeah, thanks, John and Laura. You know, I love data, but it's even better getting to talk to data with people that, you know, I know and I've worked with and excited. And I love the podcast idea about embracing kind of the nerd geek in us. And so that's wonderful. You know, after that tech company, I moved to one of the public post-secondaries, a polytechnic, and had a leadership responsibility for curriculum and faculty development and instructional technology, among a number of other things. And then I moved to a leadership role at a top-ranked comprehensive university's continuing studies. But for me, the reason that my love for data has persisted is this belief, this opinion or perspective that good decisions are almost always rooted in good information. And the good information comes from data. The data itself isn't necessarily the information, but it's going to be rooted to get the good information if you know how to convert that data into the information you're looking for.
You know, and it is one of those things where Richard and I and yourself, Laura, we all work together at that tech company. We're trying very hard not to name right now. Richard and I actually worked together at a virtual school in Alberta quite a little ways before that. And I was just thinking about your love of data and how at that time, we didn't pay attention to the data at all. We often did things in spite of the data, just trying to get them done in a hurry. So it was one of those things where I can see how it would have been a lot better if we took the time and looked at some of the data and maybe planned a little bit better. Hey, can you maybe talk about some of the experiences you've had with your data and learning value specifically? Because we want to know about like making sense of data in today's world, specifically with learning. That's what we're after.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times when we look at, you know, data broadly, you know, these principles can transfer between different sectors and different domains. But in the learning side, the data often is going to come at it from really one of maybe two or three elements. One is the data that helps support or identify or lead to the outcomes of the purpose or objectives behind the learning. You know, so if we think of, you know, at every learning, we should have an objective or an outcome. And the data helps us identify, did we get to that location? You know, are we on the track for the journey? And then the other side of data in the learning sphere often relates to that return on investment. So it's an accountability aspect, because when we proceed with an activity, especially outside of maybe your public education or the public good element of education, into learning that's related to an organizational goal, then there's often that accountability aspect. And so when I think about, you know, with learning with data, it's often related to data coming out of a learning management system or maybe some other type of performance data. And when we think now about what the world's gone through with COVID, there's a lot of questions about what are we learning about the changes that we've faced in education at any level, corporate or primary education or secondary or post, secondary, is, with the way that we're getting that information back, can we mitigate some other risks in a very tumultuous world by using some data to help us out? So, that's kind of the nuance from the learning aspect of how I've seen data being used.
It is fascinating. One of the key things that you said from that is the simple practice of tying your learning to some kind of a measurable objective or some kind of a measurable outcome, even that very basic piece is something that I see it doesn't really take place as often as it could or as well as it should.
Yeah, definitely. And there's kind of an interesting nuance about data. That one type of exploration or research with the data is really exploratory. You're not really going in with the intent to find or confirm something specific, but you're looking and going, well, what's in here? And so for those of us that are explorers, those of us that, are just kind of looking to see what's new that we haven't seen, there's a whole realm there. And then there's the realm of more that traditional hypothesis testing, where this is the objective and our purpose in this case with the data and the research is to either validate or invalidate hypothesis that we have. And, there was a cartoon that I saw decades ago, and I can't remember, which paper it was in, but the cartoon depicted a CEO at the head of a boardroom table, and the CEO was doing a little bit of fist pumping on the table, and the caption read, "Now go get me the stats to prove it." And we have to be careful when we're testing a hypothesis that we're not really going, we've already made the decision. Now we're just trying to, reinforce our point. But at the same time, we don't want to get lost in the weeds of, trying to overthink all the data, because then we close our eyes to the aha moments, would you look at that? And some of the most exciting parts of the data is when we find something we didn't perceive. And so, as we go through that, I think that's kind of a big part of this process of why are we doing it? Are we exploring? Or are we testing?
Yeah. Well, and I get curious around, you find these aha moments. So what have been some of the, more recent aha moments that you've had with some of the data that maybe you've been exposed to?
Yeah. So one of the things that we were doing is we were looking at our marketing. The marketing of our continuing education offerings and website traffic, and that we wanted to find out how effective a marketing campaign would be. And there's lots of people out there that, would relate to this regardless of what service or product that you're using, and looking at website traffic. And one of the interesting things that we were, just testing was, what is the relationship between when the emails go out and when people click on it? And, mm-hmm. When do you send out your reminder email and what sort of the pattern is? And so we had a hypothesis that we were testing. And so we were displaying a number of elements graphically, and there was this interesting blip that we did not expect. And, mm-hmm. and we thought, well, what's that? And we went in and looked at it, and it ended up just being an artifact. It was nothing. It was really nothing. It was just kind of a random outlier. But what happened was we were like, well, that's an interesting thing with this random outlier. Maybe we should check into a couple other things. And we wanted to look at our print distribution. Mm-hmm. And there was this belief that our print distribution was just as effective and it was doing certain things. And what we found when we analyzed the data of when the print calendar went out with courses, that for certain courses, there was no bump whatsoever. And we were like, that can't be true. And so we went back 5 years of data and confirmed that for a particular group of courses, it did not matter when the print calendar went out, but it mattered when the electronic information went out. Mm-hmm. And so from a learning aspect, we're like, wow, now we have to think about these audiences in a different way. And so then that leads you down another path. So that's the sort of ahas that you're looking for one thing, but you know, out of the peripheral vision, you see something else.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, that's a pretty really good example of that too. But you made a couple of comments about confirmation bias in data and things like that. So now I have to ask about an interesting confirmation bias that you might have discovered in the data. And that is probably the nerdiest sounding sentence I think I've ever said.
Yeah, well, you know, definitely there's beliefs that people will have. And I think, you know, I'll speak to a generality. The worst guilty parties on a confirmation bias is when somebody represents the data in a visual way. Often it's a PowerPoint with a bar chart or a line graph. And they will look at that and they will say, look, see the bars go up here, they go down there, the line's trending this way. And they just show that visually based on that aspect, but they don't have the nerdy team with them to ask the questions about validity or reliability or statistical significance. And so they just take that visual display and they assume, yep, that's proved my case. I don't need to explore it anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a common one. And I would suggest with a recent election in a nearby country that you can see confirmation bias, you know, happening because people will look at the same pieces of data and come to completely different conclusions.
You know, I've looked at a couple of Venn diagrams and asked a question like, is it a statistically significant sample size? And then I got looked at like I had an extra head. It was one of those types of questions. It's like, oh, let me see your data, please.
Yeah. Well, and a couple of years ago, you know, I got an interesting education that somebody said, actually, for this data set, your sample size is so large that it's going to make everything look statistically significant. So we should actually use a higher degree of threshold to just rule out false positives because of the size of the sample. And I never thought about, because we often hear, you know, do you have a large enough sample? I never had thought about if the sample becomes so large, then all of a sudden you might actually make conclusions that aren't really warranted.
So maybe for some of us, and I would say that I'm still a newbie in the data space, you had spoken when we'd had the call prior to this one and referenced aggregate data versus personal data and some of the bias related to that. I wonder if you could just unpack that for us, because that's a place where I'd like to just get a little bit more clear.
Yeah, you know, this is a very interesting and important element, not just in the learning space, but all around. But I'll focus on the learning space. So we value our privacy. We're in a world where so much is known about us, that there's so many people harvesting different pieces of data, that people have become more and appropriately concerned about, well, who has my data and what they're doing with it. So when we think about a learning environment, that personal data is really about my specific activities in this learning environment. And that can be very useful if I'm using that for myself to self-improve. But if other people are using that data to either stereotype me or using that to move forward other agenda items that I've not agreed to, then that's going to be inappropriate. So when we think about the personal data, having personal data available to the person going through the learning experience so that they can learn and that they can adjust their course of what's working, what's not working for them, that's a great way to use personal learning analytic data. Mm-hmm. Whereas aggregate data decontextualizes the identifiable information. You don't know who is which response. And with that aggregation, with a sufficient sample size, you can then help the system improve. So if you are trying to move a body of knowledge forward or a competency set forward, you know, across a large number of people, then that aggregate data is good for you to deal with system issues. And so when we're looking at or considering what data we're collecting, which parts of the data fields we need, knowing are we looking at that aggregate or personal data and what the purpose is, and then making sure that we're on the right side of the ethical line on the use of either of those, I think is appropriate. And so when you, take out that personal identifying information and aggregate it, at least you have greater confidence to prevent some of the abuses that happen on the personal data side.
Yeah, and there are a lot of them. And unfortunately, most corporate entities don't have a human research ethics committee or any kind of an ethical stopgap for this type of thing when they're going through their data, not like the post-secondaries.
Well, and not only that, just who has access to the data and, you know, the metadata that's held behind. And so, you know, if the people that are engaging or facilitating the overall project don't understand those implications, they can make a lot of decisions up front without realizing the risks that are they're undertaking for their organization.
Well, and I guess that kind of leads me down the path of, you know, as adult learning professionals and the people in like the nerdiness of learning, you know, who do we need to become? Like, what are some of the traits or the things that we need to become more aware of when it comes to data? Like, I'm just trying to like picture into the future, because I think the future looks very different for a number of reasons, not the least of which is some of the machine learning and the AI space that I don't know if anyone's truly started to wrap their heads around how that will impact us, but you know, maybe unpack what some of your thinking is around that, Richard.
Yeah, so there's a number of different points. One, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are talking about the data science and data analytics, and there's almost this feel or a group of people that are thinking, just like reading or writing, that coding should be a basic skill that everybody should have. And I wouldn't be in that group. I think we need coders. We need people that can do that programming work, but not everybody needs to be a coder. But I believe that anybody who's touching data, whether it's the design people up front or whether it's the coders or whether it's those that are interpreting the data or those that are using the data, I think they all need to be critical thinkers. They need to be design thinkers, and they need to be basically problem-solving individuals that go, this is why we're doing it, that it's very intentional, and that they know how they're going to analyze the data, and that they also are taking the time to think about what are the issues. And so going back to that confirmation bias, each of us are going to have biases. So one of the ways that we can help self-regulate is, being our own critique committee. And so in the academic world, when somebody does a master's or a doctorate, they're going to present in front of a committee to defend that dissertation or that thesis. And that committee would pick apart all the, you know, arguments and try and find the flaws and the holes. And you have to defend that you've covered all that ground. Well, we aren't going to put everybody in front of that dissertation experience, but anybody who's using data, when they go to make a conclusion, they should sit back and say, if I was seeing this, how would I pick that apart? And so, John, you made the comment about the Venn diagram and asking about the sample size. You know, you are questioning kind of the source of the validity of that analysis, and we need to do that ourselves. We have to kind of run through that. And there's lots of great literature about kind of a checklist of what you run through. And if you do that authentically and honestly, then you're going to actually get a lot further along. And then if we're seeing somebody else's data, there's also another element that I think we need to become. We need to ask who's collecting the data and why they're collecting it, so we can know if they have potential biases. Because people could be interested in the same pieces of data for very different reasons. Mm-hmm. And so asking that is important. one of the things that I don't think we all need to become, but we need to have somebody around us who can do it, is to be able to analyze the treatment of the data and the programming and the coding to make sure that you don't bake in some bias in that stage. And a lot of the current thinking in data as a whole, and especially in learning data, is what was put into place on how that data was done. So if somebody gives you a data package and you just apply it, but you don't know how it's being treated, then you can result in issues. And Laura, you were talking about AI. I don't know if you guys have done this, but at any time, just Google Chihuahua and Muffin.
Okay.
and go to Google and do and Google Chihuahua and Muffin and images, and you will see a tile of, like, you know, some image that will have a tile of some like 4x6. And in the tile will be Chihuahuas and Muffins, and they will look almost the same. And if you ran an AI and said, I want you to identify which of the Chihuahuas and Muffins, if you said, I'm looking for these features, it's actually not going to be able to distinguish. That's a baked-in problem that's there. Mm-hmm. And that's a fun example, but sometimes we don't realize that until far too late. So an example of that would be, one point they were training an AI to identify in a series of images who the cook was. But in the programming, they programmed it in a way that the AI trained it itself, that it was only looking for, it was treating it more for females than males, because the people that doing the program had a baked in bias.
That's interesting.
And there's a lot of current literature about how we got to be careful with AI, because people that are writing these default programs, you know, are treating it differently. And again, there was an interesting article about people that were presidential, and color became an issue because of how they set up the programming. And those are pretty embarrassing things for a programmer when they realize that programming language is not quite as unbiased as they thought it would be, because of the way that they've trained it or programmed it. So I think when you ask the question, what do we need to become? We need to make sure there's the right people with the right skills, whether it's collection or treatment or analyzing or presentation, that they have the tool set to not make those biases.
Yeah, and you know, the conversation that I was having before, when I asked to see the data behind it, it actually absolutely did come from an authentic place, and I just really wanted to know, because kind of a data geek, it's one of those things. And the person when I asked it got a little bit defensive because I was challenging their data. The place we got to in that conversation was how correlation does not mean there's causation. That just because things seem to be aligning on a graph does not mean that there's a causal relationship with them. And the example that came up is one that you guys have probably both heard. It's if you compare the number of pirates in the world to the rate of global warming that's going on, there's obviously something going on there. There's something to do with the reduction of the number of pirates in the world, and global warming is going up. Look, the data says it. It's right here. So that was kind of a fun aside, and the meeting got basically shut down after that.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a great example. There's actually a book out there of somebody who's done what they call spurious data correlations, and they've got all sorts of examples just like that one. And I think when we look at how we interpret the data, you know, one of our former colleagues at the aforementioned technology company, you know, used to teach us that, you know, part of our effort is to demystify. And I think when we think about making data into information, part of that is the demystifying. And, you know, some of us, we could look at a very complex table with a bunch of numbers and we can go, okay, I can see the pattern and I understand the data. And other people might not see it until it's put in a visual form. And others might look at that a table and think they see a pattern, but there's actually nothing in there. And so knowing how we can go through to do that, and you know, that's one of the cautions when we just, you know, run visualizations without knowing what it's doing.
You know, we're talking about data here, and you know, it's the kind of thing we're talking about, the different pitfalls and interpretation and things like that. What do learning professionals need to do when we're trying to handle data? How can we be thoughtful about this?
You know, I think it kind of goes back to the, what is the purpose of the data? Mm-hmm. You know, because it's hard to be thoughtful if we don't know what the purpose is. And you know, sometimes we do get information or are led in a way to solve a problem or an issue or explore something that we didn't intend to or expect. And we find something new. But really, the first thing is, are we getting the information that we were looking for from the original purpose? And, you know, part of that is saying, all right, have I been thoughtful about choosing my data properly to get the information I need? Because a lot of times you just say, go get me data, and they go and grab whatever numbers are available and whatever reports available or whatever output that our learning management system or performance system has. But was that actually the thing that's going to get us to the information? And the second thing that I think we need to think about is, data usually leads us closer, but isn't the silver bullet. We need to be able to contextualize that data into the information, go, now what's the action as a result of it? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes people just go, I need to make the number bigger. You know, oh, okay, the data says this, let's grow that number by 40%. Well, that's not really understanding what it is. It's about, you know, what are we after? And how can we, you know, move that forward? And so I think deciding what is the strategy or strategies that are best served by getting more information, and then spending our valuable time and resources, whether it's your time or resource or others, we don't want to be spending it on something that's not a key strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that makes perfect sense. And you know, it's one of those things when I go into organizations and I find these files and these folders filled with reams and reams of data, course evaluations and everything like that. And I say, what are you guys doing with this? And they say, oh, we keep it. That's, how long do you keep it for? Well, 7 to 10 years for tax purposes. I said, have you ever looked at it to see what it's telling you? Oh, okay. So it's one of those things, we're just keeping that data because we've always kept that data.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Laura.
Yeah, I think there's an unpacking though. Like, so what I love is that you're pointing to the goals, right? So what are the results we want? And I think I kind of harp on this because I'm super passionate about it, but also because I think it's a place where we get kind of superficial as learning professionals from time to time. It's like, well, we just want to get all of the people through XYZ training or learning experience. Well, is that the only reason you're doing it? Or is there some other goal that you're seeking? And so in the, there's a lot when you say like, know what you're aiming for or what the results are. That whole piece for me needs to be unpacked, because then there's like, what are the measurements or the data points that are going to help inform or help you understand what you should even be looking at and how you can kind of see into the peripheral. But I don't know that people get really crystal clear about those results. So I kind of question that piece. I'm not sold that they actually do look critically at what is the result and how do you backtrack?
There's a great quote that is often attributed to Einstein. And it's probably better attributed to somebody named William Bruce Cameron, a sociologist from, I think, the 60s. You know, that people might have heard, not everything that can be counted counts, or some variation of that quote. And I think you've kind of touched on that about, you know, they just collecting the data and they're not sure what they're using it for and does it count? And in the learning sphere, the two biggest types of data that I've seen being collected are participation rates. Mm-hmm. So how many people attended the workshop? You know, what percentage is that of the company, right? And you'll often see an HR department saying, we need to get, you know, number of people through, and maybe it's a, some sort of compliance training, a safety training, or a diversity training, that the company's goal there is not that everybody, they might have a wish that everybody is incorporating the values out of that safety training, or out of that privacy training, or out of that diversity training, but since they don't know how, or they aren't held accountable to the actual outcomes, they just go, we need to point that every staff member went to the training. So when organization X, Y, or Z comes in to audit us, that we prove that we deliver training. So their goal really is just, you know, they may not say it this way, but their goal is to be able to hold up a sign and saying, we've been good people here. We made everybody take this training.
Richard, don't tell people the secret. They're not supposed to know that compliance training isn't about learning. Compliance training has never been about learning. It's about a check mark on a page.
Yeah. And so, you know, you have that. And then the second type of data that's most often collected is that end of experience survey. And people then use that as a proxy for quality.
Say more.
So if those numbers are high, we are going to tell whoever that we're accountable to that we deliver quality training because these numbers are high. And it doesn't mean that those end of experience training surveys don't give us some information about quality, but it's this, I can just put a number on it and then somebody goes, well, we want to be more quality, make that number get bigger. And then somebody goes, you know, last year that number was an average of 4.63 out of 5. This year it's 4.64. Look at how much better we are. And we totally miss statistical significance, and we miss all sorts of other things. And it gives us a pulse, maybe. It can be an early warning indicator if those numbers are 1 out of 5, assuming 1 is a lower number, you know, in terms of the quality. And this gets into our measurement, you know, is very satisfied the 1 or is very satisfied the 5? And have you been consistent with that? And what are you using as your control measures? And you get into all sorts of other stuff. But a lot of times the non-data people, they just want to see a number that tells them it's good. Mm-hmm. Oh, you did good there. Thumbs up. And, you know, we sometimes misuse those. And then there's another problem with those satisfaction surveys is that there's all sorts of biases that can be baked into what people put in those numbers. So, you know, did you give out nice, wonderful, high quality chocolates 5 minutes before you handed out the survey? And the last thing that was on their mind and that is still on their tongue is how good that chocolate tasted. And did that raise that number over the person that actually gave a better quality learning experience in that workshop or whatever it was that you're evaluating? But at the very end of it, they had a really awkward moment and they belched and you were like, well, that kind of was gross. Right. And so all sorts of different, you know, environmental and other situations, you know, get pulled into it. You know, was the classroom that the training was in really hot? And as a result, they made negative comments about the instructor. Did you ask a separate question so you know what those numbers mean? So a lot of times we focus on the data of participation and this satisfaction thing, but we don't look at it and go, well, actually, how did people's behavior change afterwards? Yeah. Was the behavior sustained? You know, did we have less health and safety issues happen because people understood, no, I should not put my hand in front of that slicing saw without, you know, making sure that the guard is on, right? Like, you know, different things that we're considering. And so that's kind of back to the outcome of, well, what is it that's really important and how are you measuring that? And then that retention aspect, you know, do you come back to those learners a year later and have some sort of evaluative tool to see how much they retained? You know, we don't typically do those things.
You know, it's one of those things. I come from a Kirkpatrick evaluation background, and the happy sheets are always good. But actually following up 3 months later to say, hey, what did you remember out of the training? What did you remember out of that experience and that type of thing? We actually did that at one of my positions, and it was fascinating to hear what people would actually remember. It was never what you intended. It was never about the content. It was some experience they had or some story that somebody told or something. So we would sort of go through and say, okay, yeah, happy sheets. People like the temperature, they like the lunch and that type of thing. Not a lot of data there. But then when you follow it up after to see if learning actually took place, we had no idea what we're going to get. And then I was actually in an organization that let us follow up about 6 months later and check with supervisors and see if the behavior had changed. And of course, the supervisors all said, yes, we can think so. But they didn't keep the right data on the behavior change to follow up from the training. So we had to start over.
Yeah. Well, and it makes me think about the connection to how behaviors are actually changed and what we're measuring and tracking in terms of leading indicators versus lagging indicators. Like, I think there's a whole conversation there that, you know, maybe not today, but at a future time, I would love to just dig into, because there's something else there that's could tell us a different story and help us really pick apart, like, what are those leading indicators that are going to give us those lagging results?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot there. I don't know, I keyed in on so much that you just said, Richard, and to be quite honest, I'm still unpacking a bit of it, but I think the piece that stood out for me is that we're kind of obsessed with this bums in seats mentality of let's get the reach data, let's make sure that everyone's happy, and you know, that'll be good enough. And I think the thing that I keep getting kind of hopped up on is that it's not good enough, because then everything that we do in my head becomes a compliance experience. Like, if that's all we care about and that's all we want to prove, then what difference are we actually making in the business then? And I really struggle to see value in episodic training, much like I struggle to see value in gathering data related to engagement surveys or the like, because it's episodic, it's moment in time, and it doesn't, on the whole, tell the whole story. It just tells a moment in time.
It's interesting commentary, and I think one of the answer that if I was speaking to somebody in the corporate world, they'd say, oh, we're managing risk, we're making sure that we're covering all of our bases, we're managing our liability and things like that too. And based on our conversation and some of the ideas that we've been talking about, I think the question that I really want to ask is, are you really? Have you ever even looked at the results to see if you put everybody through this workspace hazardous materials training class? Did it actually reduce the number of incidents? And if it didn't, does that mean it's a failure? More questions than answers right now.
You know, I think actually that's a great line, because that's what any data, but learning analytics for this discussion does, is you often create a lot of questions to follow up on. And that's why the data itself isn't the solution. And knowing how you would use the data and then being prepared actually to shift and respond based on what the information is that come out of that. And so when you asked, you know, made the comment about, well, what do you use the data for? You know, that same, are you actually implementing anything from that learning? And, you know, since we're talking about learning and we're talking about change, has the person who's asked for the data actually learned anything from the data about learning?
Ooh, I love that.
And so, you know, again, another quote that, you know, gets attributed all over the place, and I don't know actually where it's most attributed. People want to say Drucker, but I don't think it was actually originally him, was some version of culture eats strategy for breakfast or lunch or whatever, you know, you want to put in there. But if the culture of an organization is not a learning culture, then their learning activity data will probably get crushed under the culture. Mm-hmm. It won't be used. But if the culture is a learning culture, then that data can inform and enhance and move forward strategy.
Mm-hmm. It is one of the things in organizations that I found is they do collect all this data, but they don't take action because they don't know what the action is. And it is kind of the whole, one of our learning conundrums that we have is there's this identified business need. There's a problem. There's some kind of an issue in the organization. There's a problem. So somebody comes along and says, hey, let's build some training to solve that problem. And it, which is well and good because you identify the need, you build the training that's going to solve the need. Then you put the training out there in the world. And then it kind of stops. There's that missing step between we built all this training and people are going through this training. How do we actually make sure that they're changing their behavior? How do we know that they're actually using this training? And you can't do that without the data. You need to be mindful about the data you collect.
I agree. The vast majority of the corporate training methodology is more about risk mitigation or problem solving. But it's not exclusively that. And I think an organization that's forward thinking is actually using the learning to focus on what are their successes. And so, you know, what's often spoken of out in the kind of the world is this strength-based approach. And you know, if I wanted to be a forward-thinking organization, I might go, what do we know are the things that make us most successful and design the learning to do more of that or refine that further rather than always treating learning as a remedial model. Because if I think about so many of the training sessions that I've sat in or even ones that I've been tasked to deliver, it's often from a remedial standpoint. You know, you are deficient. This training is to make you not as deficient, mm-hmm. as opposed to this is a strength of ours. And this training is actually to help us as an organization to brainstorm and move forward. And we can energize people. And in that case, I think people are going to be more open to the follow-up types of data measures that we might have, mm-hmm. because it's success focused as opposed to, oh, they're going to follow up with me. And if I don't get a good score, then I'm going to be sent off to remedial school again. Then their authenticity in their evaluations, I think, is compromised.
It feels like it's a punishment when it's some kind of, oh, we have this deficiency. Nobody in the organization knows how to deal with diversity. So everybody's going through diversity training. Everybody's taking it. And then we'll be diverse. It's like, not quite.
Yeah. I was thinking of that exact example because I've heard and seen of it. It's like, well, we have to deal with this, so we're going to roll out diversity training. But it does. It, like, having been on the other side of some training sessions, there is kind of a punishment aspect to it because it's not about acknowledging that there's a place that I can grow that I'm already good at. It's really just here's this thing that we have to react and respond to. And so here's what we're going to do to mitigate. I love that. That really put the picture together for me. Thank you. I saw it in a new way because I often refer to it, Richard and John, as like a transfer of liability. Compliance-based training and reactive training is just a transfer of liability. It's not just a check mark to me. It's a way for a company to say, I've done everything that I can. Now it's on you. And it's the equivalent of a dismissal of a sort to that individual. And it just, it's for me a little disheartening, I guess. Like, and I love the idea of kind of getting to that strength-based approach where we're actually going, here's the things that we know we're good at and we're going to be fantastic at.
And yet we probably shouldn't really be surprised because if we think at our personal experiences in our primary education that we took, you know, long before university and even before high school, you know, a lot of times it's you know, in that middle school era that we have all of a sudden determined that there's certain subjects that we have an affinity for, mm-hmm. and those that we don't have an affinity for. And sometimes those affinities are related to the teacher that we had, who was the one that was leading us in that learning journey. You know, that can have a big impact on it. But there are certain skills that maybe were more difficult for us to acquire. And the more that people said, oh, we need to deal with this deficiency, as opposed to, you know, letting us embrace and enjoy the things that we had strengths in. And and measure how successful we are in that, that changes our attitudes about the topic that we have. Mm-hmm. And that we have about the topic, more correctly. And so when we think about when we go through our measures back to that, you know, end of experience survey, you know, where you called it the happy survey, you know, John, you know, some of those things are going to be come out of what is our default position of impression and enjoyment with the topic. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm in a session that has a topic that I'm totally all into, it's more likely I'm going to get the nuggets and gems out of that in spite of or despite of the actual delivery experience I might have had. And somebody who's in a session that they're really not keen about because of how that they were, you know, added to that class roster, as it were, might have a very different experience in terms of what they rated that just based on those elements.
Mm-hmm. I love you calling out that the internal motivation to become a learner in any session really sets the tone for that experience. Like it creates, like the learner creates that experience. And so just as much, you know, coming to the end of the session, happy sheets or smile sheets, whatever you want to refer to them as, part of what determines how I feel at the end of the session is me. And so if I take that data from all of those single individuals and how they're feeling that day, that's a part and parcel of that picture that we're getting from those smile sheets. So yeah, I love the place of continuing to look. And actually the piece that stood out to me that you said earlier is that it's a place to start asking more questions and to be more curious versus just accepting the data like at a face value without looking any deeper. I think that's the piece that I'm taking away from this conversation, is that data is a way to ask more questions. And yeah, that's really powerful. Thank you for that.
Well, and both John and Laura, if you think back to our experiences that we had collectively at that one company doing, you know, some training there, we had a question on our end of learning experience that asked about the hands-on activities, mm-hmm. because we had hands-on activities. And we recognized in there a pattern that the average score aggregated across all sessions throughout a year, that was this area that had the lowest of the scores. Mm-hmm. And instead of treating it as a fully remedial thing and going to all the people that had responsibility to do the training and saying, you must be better at doing the hands-on training, you remember, what did we do? We went back and actually looked at the training design, mm-hmm. and said, what do we need to do differently with the actual activities in here that actually are going to make them there? And then you ask the question, are they unsatisfied because there's not enough of them? Are they unsatisfied because they're not relevant to their job, what they're going to do afterwards, that they were like, well, that's great, you did a hands-on activity, but I'm never going to use that again. Are you unsatisfied because the nature of the activity, they were just like, oh, that felt really weird, you know, and that they didn't like it. So that's where you ask the questions. The signpost that the data gave us was, the information was, look closer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The information wasn't, this is the problem to solve. It's, hey, you should look closer here.
I think that's what data does, is, as you said before, it opens some doors and makes you look at things a little bit differently. I know that there's an intrinsic motivation for learning. You're in the class and you're there and you're ready to learn. But the design of the content, the way it's delivered, the person that's delivering it can have a huge impact. When you were talking before, it made me think about my middle school math teacher that made it so I didn't like math anymore. Because up until that point, I was good at math. And then I got a teacher who I kind of went, well, this is the most boring experience I've ever had in my entire life, and I have to do it every day for the next 4 months. And at the end of that, I'm like, I really don't like math anymore. So there is an impact, and that wasn't based on the data, but I'm sure that we could have some interesting data on the feelings from that specific instructor.
And behalf of all of my fellow math teacher colleagues, because John, as you indicated, we had worked together at a virtual school, you know, that we recognized that just in every discipline, there's those that are good that are not good. But it is interesting that experience is more commonly shared about math. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. right? Like if you were to pick a subject and say, which subject, you know, was the one that you found at a certain point that you didn't like math is often going to be there. So if you research the data, then you have to go, well, why is that? You know, because it's probably not because every math teacher was less proficient than the other teachers. So again, this goes back to, you know, the data says, why do we ask the question? So it's a mix. It's the learner, it's the individual, it's the rest. And I think, Laura, you asked me before about aggregate data and personal data. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is interesting there is when we make a judgment without understanding all the context. And mm-hmm. that's one of the dangers of the personalized data pieces.
Yeah, because it's always about the context of those answers. Yeah. And I feel like we're winding down, and I guess there's a piece that I really wanted to acknowledge. And I say this, and I think I've said it to you before, Richard, but you know, that time in that technology company and getting a chance to work with you and John and so many others on that team, it's kind of like a place where I grew up. Right? I feel like I grew up a little bit there. I wouldn't say that I've grown up now, so let's not get carried away. But there was this piece around getting a mini MBA and this appreciation that you brought into my life around data and measurement and then looking at the data and asking new questions. And my personality, like naturally, that's not who I am. I want to make gut calls and intuitive leaps, and I will do it all day, every day, if I'm allowed to. And so I'm grateful for that early influence in my life because I think it gave me a place to slow down and get curious as opposed to constantly leaping to assumptions. And so, and I don't think I would ever do it naturally without your influence. So I'm really grateful that you chose to be with us today, that you're willing to dive deeply into the conversation, because I feel like I'm taking away a new appreciation for the curiosity that must be there every time we talk about data. So thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, and I'd like to add my thanks also, Mr. Rush. I appreciate all of our conversations, and every time we do it, I learn a little bit more. Sometimes your honesty is very, very pointed, and it's always appreciated when you've directed that lens my way. Yeah. It's one of those things, but yeah, it's having a conversation like this about data. It's not the type of topic that most people get excited about. I get excited about it, and I think that talking to somebody like you, Richard, makes it a lot clearer. So it's easier to get excited about it when somebody takes the time to sort of explain it and come with real world examples and that type of thing. So I appreciate you and want to pass my thanks on.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of fun, and you know, I excited to hear where you guys go with the rest of your topics in this podcast. So thanks for allowing me to be a part of it.
Yeah, this and so many more, because I feel like every time that we talk to people like you, Richard, there's so many more questions that come up for me, and I have tangents in my head and I can barely type fast enough to keep up with them. So there'll be more, folks. And so waiting for those next podcasts and the next guests that we're already talking to. So thanks for listening. Thanks for taking the time. John, over to you.
All right, and that's it for the Learning Value Podcast. I'd like to say thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and stay tuned. We'll have more exciting guests in the future.